If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Behind the Curtain, where we're taking the political pulse, a look at the political landscape with the author of the best-selling Hardball, somebody who had a show called Hardball for decades on MSNBC. I'm sure you've seen him. All the NBC news shows you didn't have an election night without Chris Matthews hanging at that table and telling us his thoughts. His new book, an autobiography, is called This Country, My Life in Politics and History. Chris, I followed you for a long time. I read this book cover to cover because it really taught me how you think and how you tick. And I just want to kick off by saying you grew up Irish Catholic, Republican family. When did it turn?
Well, it happened, I think, civil rights and Vietnam War and little issues like Social Security and things which I talk about with my dad. And I realized that the conservative point of view, which I sort of had in high school, really wasn't workable, that you needed to look out for people in their old age, and you had to make them do it themselves through forced savings, through paying Social Security, the payroll tax. And civil rights wasn't going to get done through the constitutional amendment process. It had to be done by politics. And that Lyndon Johnson really did it and got it through with the help of Everett Dirksen, the Republican leader, who actually provided more votes. But the Vietnam War really kept going and going and going, and Nixon just wouldn't change, and it was a hopeless war. Now we find out through the Pentagon Papers that they all knew it was a disaster, it wasn't going to work. And that, to me, is ruthless politics, to keep people getting killed and killing people, knowing it wasn't going to work, that this country of Vietnam is going to be independent, basically. Certainly independent of us, if not the Soviet Union. The irony is that now I'm a professor over there at Fulbright University Vietnam in Ho Chi Minh City, and I've been teaching now for the last year over there by Zoom.
Modern technology. You know, you go through your entire life in the book. You're growing up, pictures of you, your brothers, the whole family. But you start the book in the introduction in 1974, the era of Watergate being all over the news, and you basically said that was around when, you know, you felt it might be time for an alternative. Would people be looking for something different? And so that sets us up for your whole life. I'm sort of curious, in order for there to be change in a city, in a state, in our country, do you need some kind of major event like a Watergate, like a COVID, like a something? Is that what propels, or disastrous economy 2008? Is that what propels people to make the change?
Well, it certainly did in 1932 with the Great Depression, where the Democratic Party became a modern political party and basically became the dominant party in the United States Congress for all these years, off and on. But mainly it was the Great Depression. But then, of course, the Vietnam War, for a lot of people my generation, really changed their lives. They saw the stakes. They saw that if government makes the wrong decisions, people are going to die. I think a big development for me was probably, I didn't mention before, Paul, but it was the Kennedy assassination. I think I was permanently changed by that. It got to me in a way that I never would have ever predicted anything would get to me. I just really felt something happened to me when Jack Kennedy was killed. I was at Holy Cross up in Massachusetts at the time, and I was going to class and got the word, and went over and sat down in the basement of a dormitory and listened to Walter Cronkite all afternoon giving us this story. And in 1 hour, a country that focused completely on Jack Kennedy, this human being, this one person in the country, all focus on him, all conversation was about him, for or against him, and wonder at him in many ways. All of a sudden, he's not there. And it had nothing to do with us as the voters, as the American people. We just lost him. And I think it really got to me, and in ways that I can't fully explain.
Well, your career, of course, from that moment, you move on. I mean, people may or may not know you actually ran for office yourself. I think a lot of people know you were a speechwriter for President Carter. You were in the Peace Corps. I mean, I know a lot about that career. recently, I think, because of your book, people like me have learned you were in the Capitol Police. But what I want to ask you about, not so much your reminiscence, that's in the book, you talk about that. But, you know, one of your rules, and I have to tell you, I've heard from some young people who know I'm talking to you on the podcast, who follow your career, and they've kind of, there's certain things they want to know from you in our interview as they read the book, too. One of the rules you have in the book, essentially, is show up, right? You went door to door, knocking on, I'm thinking of a guy named Christopher who's kind of doing what you did, knock on the doors, try and get a job. But, you know, Richard J. Daley, mayor of Chicago years ago, who you're very familiar with, once said, "I don't want to see anybody. Nobody's sent." The whole notion of patronage. That's how Capitol Police came through for you, right? It was a patronage job, to be honest. But do you have to know somebody to be connected
that's
today?
That's the old school rule. That's what I ran against in Philadelphia when I challenged the machine. And we in Philadelphia still have a machine, like in Chicago. We have, you know, my grandfather was one of Democratic committeemen. Everything is controlled by the party endorsement and who gets endorsed and who's on the slate and who isn't. It's still like that in Philly. It's very hard to beat the machine. But when I went to Washington after coming home from the Peace Corps, I had no alternative. I didn't have any connections. I didn't have anybody calling for me or having my name being approved by somebody. And certainly a lot of the offices were like that. But I just kept knocking doors. So I started out with the Irish Catholics, thinking I'd have a better chance with those guys because of Kennedy and the Peace Corps and Holy Cross and everything. But I ended up with a Mormon from Utah is hiring me. And he was the last liberal senator from Utah, actually, Frank Moss. And that's how I got my start. And I got started as a Capitol policeman, as a patronage job, working from 3 to 11 with my uniform and my 38 police special gun. And then working in the office every morning answering complicated letters until after about 3 months. I said, enough of this. I said to the top guy, I want to be a legislative assistant, and I got the job. But it was just, I say to every kid when I give a graduation speech, I say, nobody's coming to your door and knocking on your door and say, oh, I saw what your dream was last night. Maybe I can help you. It's never going to happen. You have to knock on their door. You have to hustle. And you can't send emails either. They don't have any power. You have to get to the person, get them in the face if you can, and say, how about me?
Why do you think a senator from Utah, Frank Moss, why does he go to you? Isn't there somebody from Utah he could have and should have
fired? Well, I went to him. I went to him. I went knocking on the door. I got an interview with his top aide. He liked the fact I knew economics. He had worked for Bobby Kennedy's presidential campaign a couple years before. He had ran the Rocky Mountains for Bobby Kennedy. I just happened to get finally the right guy. That's what I can tell you. After 200 doors, you would find the right guy. A Southern guy. I was so desperate. At one point, I took an interview with a guy from Texas named Jim Collins, and he didn't like me. He said, I talked too fast. My hair was too long, blah, blah, blah. Go work for some liberal up north. But before he left before the meeting was over, he said, you know, I used to sell life insurance door to door. He said, before I get into this business, as he put it. And he said, you know, I used to have a pattern. I said, if I went to 100 doors each day, I would get 9 offers to come back and meet with the husband, because usually the wife was at home. And of those 9 meetings at home to sell life insurance, I would sell 3 policies. And I knew if I didn't get those 9 meetings, I couldn't sell the 3 policies. And if I didn't go to 100 houses, I wouldn't get the 9 meetings. He said, that's what life's like. Boy, what a great lesson. Some people are going to like you, and some people aren't. So find the people that like you, and it'll change your life.
Well, at least you got to hang with Robert Redford in Utah for a day, right?
He was great, yeah. He was at the top of his career because he had just done Butch Cassidy about Utah Cowboys, Outlaws, and I just walked up to usually young women in the big shopping malls, and I said, would you like to meet Bob Redford? Bob Redford, like he's my old pal. I'd say, Bob, I'd like you to meet Sylvia or Mary or somebody. It was fun because it was just helping young people meet a celebrity. What a great way to spend a day in Utah.
By the way, one other thing I want to button up. You had mentioned that the Kennedy assassination may have been what changed you, perhaps turned you sort of more Democratic side, but you were a Goldwater supporter in 1964. That's post-assassination. So I'm wondering, are you sure it wasn't like Peace Corps, something that happened?
I wasn't really still with Goldwater as much. I was more with Goldwater in 60, 61, 62. I read National Review, Bill Buckley's book, magazine, and I can tell you, I did show up at a Fenway Park rally for Goldwater. I did, but I was not really gung-ho like I had been before, as a fact. I mean, Hillary Clinton was a Goldwater girl. That's what she called. That's what they called them. They wore a sash.
Right.
You were really all excited. I was a young person. It was Goldwater appealed to the libertarian in me, and probably in her. You know, when you want the government off your back, you want people to make their own decisions. You want to have true freedom, individual freedom. No, I think Goldwater was a very appealing candidate, and everybody liked him. Even Jack Kennedy liked him. I mean, he was a he grew up a cowboy, a real Westerner.
So at what point you decide to run for Congress in Philly, you do, you took on the machine, not yet again learning your lesson, I suppose, although you did well, but not yet learning your lesson about the fact that it's tough to beat a powerful machine. The machines of those days, anyway.
Yeah, I think they're still that way in Philly. I think you people, you know, every week there's a ward, there's a ward meeting where all the committee people meet and they plan voter turnout and, you know, I think they're committed to it. And, of course, they can fix parking tickets. And in the old days, they could get you a Senate scholarship, a state Senate scholarship. They're nice to have as your friends. It's good to have some political pull, even locally. And they still they show up. It's a big by poll. They're always at the polls. They grab all the people they know and say, don't forget to vote for this guy. And they can walk up to them with their sample ballots. These are called, I don't know if they have them in Chicago. I'll tell you, they have them in Philly, which are sample ballots. And they're very nice looking. It says the official Democratic ballot. And on it are listed the candidates that have been endorsed by the party in order. So ballot position 1, then ballot position 8, then ballot position 14 or whatever, each one. And then on the back of them, for the easiness of the voter, they just have the numbers. So you just vote numbers to make it fast. And if you're in that voting booth too long, the committee wants to know what you're in there for. Why are you in there so long? Get in, out, get in and out of there. That's what they want. The machine teaches you how to vote fast and vote for the party candidates and get home.
I got to tell you, a very brief story from me. I interviewed Edley Stevenson, and he told me the story of one day, just what you're talking about. His wife, Nancy, goes in the poll to vote. You can see her legs because the curtain comes halfway down. You're supposed to hit the Democratic button and get the heck out, but Nancy doesn't. Nancy Stevenson's walking around a little bit, obviously not voting the Democratic Party ticket. The next day, Edley told me he had a building inspector, roofing inspector, and plumbing inspector from the city knocking on his door. Sound familiar?
Yeah, that's what they used to do, dirty old tricks, like they would put a little piece of coal dust on the wrong levers so your fingers would be dirty when you came out. And they knew you hadn't voted the straight ticket. I mean, I caught a guy when I was running a Republican committeeman in the booth with the voter, actually in the room with the voter. And I called him on this, and I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm rendering technical assistance. You're in the booth with the guy, buddy. He said, by the way, it's none of your business. This is a Republican primary. None of your business.
I love
anyway.
It. So you become a speechwriter. You're a speechwriter for Frank Moss, whatever. But this was amazing to me. I think it was 74. You get a call. You know, everybody knows you were a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. I had always just assumed you reached out, you applied. It was he called you.
Well, what happened was in 74, I lost the primary. And a week or two later, I get a letter from Jimmy Carter, who's chairman of the Democratic Campaign Committee, something he created, basically, campaign committee, not national committee. And he said, sorry about your loss, but don't give up on politics. Don't give up on the Democratic Party. If you please contact me. It's like I want your help. So please contact me or Hamilton Jordan and get in touch and let's get going. Now, I got to tell you, that's a powerful letter to get when you've just lost. And I found out later, he sent them to all these people, like John Gilligan of Ohio, who lost the governorship. He had that for one term. And Mitch Costanza, a woman activist up there in New York State. And a guy named Richard Pettigrew down in Florida, who had been Speaker of the House and just lost for the Senate. And then Richard Pettigrew hired me to work as his deputy for reorganizing the federal government in the White House. So this was a very interesting way of building a national campaign when you're a nobody, like Jimmy Carter was. He was a one-term governor of Georgia, deep south state, and he didn't have any national recognition. And he went out and went to all the losers. Because, as he said to his friend Jerry Rafshoon, who's a friend of mine now, who was his communications guy, I don't want the winners. They're probably going to all work for the front runners, like Scoop Jackson and Birch Bayh and Walter Mondale. I want to get the losers because they'll work for me, and they'll bring their whole organization with them. So Carter was very smart about how to do something with nothing, basically. It's what you do with what you got, and he had the ingenuity to build a national organization of people who lost elections.
I don't know how the connections. I mean, you talked about getting together with Bob Woodward, who wanted you to, you know, write your first book, Hardball. And apparently, I guess as Bob does, he records everything, right? So you talk about the fact that he recorded your interaction with him, sent you the manuscript, and said, "Here's your first draft. Keep going." But Jimmy Breslin, Ben Bradley. I mean, talk about a who's who of people you've interacted with. And I knew you wrote for the San Francisco Examiner. I did not know you were hired by Larry Kramer, who I assume was the Larry Kramer.
Yeah. Well. Larry Kramer was the guy who worked for you. I think he's a different Larry Kramer than you know. Larry Kramer was executive editor of the Examiner. He then started something called Newswatch, a sort of Dick Tracy watch, if you will. And then he became publisher of the USA Today. Yeah, he's had an amazing career, and he's friends of mine now. And Larry, out of nowhere, called me up and got me the job with the Examiner. But Jimmy Breslin walked me into the office of New York Newsday and told the editor, his editor, hire me. And he didn't do it, but Jimmy Breslin, he's the greatest, you know. And he told me, if you get this column, you got to write about regular people, not the big shots. He talked about his famous column when Kennedy was killed in 63. He went over to Arlington National Cemetery and interviewed the gravedigger who had dug Jack Kennedy's grave, and talked to him. I mean, to talk about great journalism. My God, it's breathtaking.
And when it came to Ben Bradley, you had some words. Ben could actually, you could be, I don't know, I wouldn't say nasty to him, but you'd make a point with him, and he'd come right back at you. I almost don't want to quote what you say in the book he said to you in an interaction with him, but he was pretty tough.
Language. I went in there because they'd written some article, one of his pals, Richard Harwood, had written an article about how terrible it was that people who are in politics had gone into journalism full time. And I was really upset that they picked me out again. I'm just the guy for the Examiner. That's not the biggest paper in the country. Why are you going after me when so many other people had done that? So I go into his booth, just like in the movie All the President's Men. There's Ben Bradley in his booth there, the glass walls around it. And I go in and I start yelling at him. And he says, "What, you come in here to lift your leg on me?" It's like a dog. I mean, he immediately disarms me. How can I do anything but laugh when he said that? Ben was not only a great editor, maybe the greatest editor, but he was a charmer. And you just really wanted him to be your friend. You wanted Ben Bradley, the great Benjamin Bradley, to approve of you. And thank God he did. He was my friend before he died, right till he died.
Yeah, amazing story on that. The other thing is, I want to point out to sort of, we're all complex people, Chris. A lot of people, if I say, you know, what is Chris Matthews? Oh, he's incredibly liberal, whatever. But, you know, you write about the Dukakis-Bush election, and you supported Dukakis, but you write in the book, if I read it right, you were okay with George H.W. Bush winning election. He was a good guy to you.
Yeah, I think after Clinton beat him in 92, I was hanging around with some real progressives, very highly educated Ivy League types, and this woman made a negative comment about George Sr. She said he was asked what was the best thing about being president, and he said, "It's the honor of it." And she thought that was ridiculous. And I thought she was ridiculous because, of course, it's the honor of the presidency that would be the most important thing to you. Of course, you would say things like, "I wanted to do this or that," but to a person, to have the honor of being president of the United States is the first thing that comes to your heart and your mind. My God, I've been chosen by the American people to be their leader. I'm in the footsteps of Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and FDR. What's wrong with saying an honest answer? And I thought that is the great thing about George Herbert Walker Bush. He accepted and treasured the honor of being president of the United States first and foremost. I think Bill Clinton didn't get that right. He didn't understand the importance of the honor of the office. He thought he was a little too much a 60s guy, a little too casual. You know, his people around didn't bother to get ID cards, security guards. They wore old clothes around. They didn't have that sense of old school honor that the George Herbert Walker Bush had. I think Reagan did too. I mean, Reagan would never walk into the Oval Office without his suit jacket on. Never took it off. I mean, that's old school, but it tells me this person's here to do the job, and they respect the fact that they've been given the opportunity to do it, be President of the United States.
And Obama wore a tan suit, and he took some heat.
Well, that was may have been a bad fashion choice. I don't know.
Right. You also, you know, people think of you, the hardball MSNBC, but we have to take it back. And I share a little bit of this history with you.
Let me slow you down here, Paul, because I think it's, I think people who watch me for 26 years altogether on television, they know who I am. And maybe some people, I used to always say in a positive way, when they say, I watched you, I watched, I watched Ari before you, I watched Chris Hayes after you, I said, you watch all of this? There is some difference among us, you know. I mean, I'm a little nuanced. I mean, I'm not the same as Rachel's wonderful, a wonderful human being. Couldn't be nicer to me all these years. But we're different politically. She has a different sensibility about politics. I think Ari does, and they're all different. And I know their nuances more than the viewer. But my God, we're not all the same. Nicole, you know, she was a big Republican at the White House. Right. Joe Scarborough was a big Republican, a congressman. I mean, we're all kind of listen a little more closely. I think, because I don't think I'm a simple down the line progressive. There are a couple of issues I'm big on. Like I didn't like the Iraq War, and I don't like voter suppression. But I don't think I'm the same as everybody on some of these things.
Well, and of course, you started with these shows. It wasn't just MSNBC. There was America's Talking. I used to be on that network. CNBC, Roger Ailes. You kind of interacted with Roger Ailes before he became maybe the Roger Ailes people
I
are more
I
familiar
knew the good
with
part
today.
Of Roger Ailes. I knew the good part. I didn't know the monstrous part of him. God, I don't think anybody else did. Maybe people right in his office did, but his behavior with women was awesome, was awful. And God, I didn't know about it, but. I we were all lucky to have had these jobs. These are incredibly powerful positions to have a talk show host in prime time and to be able to spend an hour before the American people with several million people watching every night. It's a treasure, and we have to all be thankful for it.
And life continues, too. I know you lost your mom to Alzheimer's in 1996. I lost my mom just a couple of years ago to Alzheimer's. What a terrible death to observe and watch. But we lose our family. That's what happens. And but I guess we should take a moment to talk about
that. Yep. My dad, Paul, was my hero because Dad took care of Mom and always protected us from the worst. And he used to say, when we say, how's Mom? He'd say, classic. And I thank the people that write these manuals about what Alzheimer's symptoms are so that the guys like my dad who are caregivers or women who take care of their husbands will know as they go through this dangerous, not dangerous, horrible part of their lives, not a great part, that the conditions and the symptoms are common. They're not personal. Most people end up taking it. Somebody says, you're stealing my money, you smell, where are you, who are you? This terrible way you react to your lifelong spouses. It's all part of the disease, and when you find that out, you can live with it a little better than if you think it's all about you.
Yeah, it was absolutely a horrendous situation.
Yeah,
Omen, talk to you about March 2nd, 2020. Your departure from Hardball. There had been some talk of some women who said you said inappropriate things to them, and one of the things that amazed me. And a
no,
couple
there was
questions
one woman
about it.
Who
number
said
one,
I congratulated her on her appearance. I admitted to that. I said, how come I haven't fallen in love with you yet? We're both in the makeup room, both looking at the mirror at the same time, and I made the comment into the mirror, basically. I totally accept her responsibility for doing that, her right to do it. I completely agree with her judgment. I accepted it. I don't think there was ever a dispute about any of the facts.
But why? Why walk? I mean, you owned it. You owned it from minute one. Why did you say, and therefore it's time for me to retire?
Well, I just thought, what can I say? I thought I didn't want to get into a dispute with the network. I thought they wanted to do something. They said something they were going to do. It wasn't about being fired or anything, but I didn't want to leave it in their hands. I thought they were under pressure. And, you know the whole history of Dare. You know, yep. I didn't want to get in part of that. I just wanted to go. I just, It was,
and I was curious about just
my wife was with me when we sat down with the President Network at that hotel, and basically she said, "Is this all there is? Is this it?" And he said, "Yeah, this is it. This is the one incident." So, what can I say?
It was, and I did have one thing I've always wondered. When you walked off that night and Kornacki filled in for you, he stepped into the seat, and I have to tell you, I love Steve Kornacki. He looked like a deer in the headlights, and I always wondered, did they know you were walking off right after the opening comments, or did they think you were going to do that show?
I don't know. I think they knew I was leaving. I don't know. I actually, Paul, I don't know, actually. I don't know. I know that Steve's a real human being, and he was teary-eyed, and I'll never forget that, and you know, it was just a strange, poignant moment. I went out with I took all my producers out and all my makeup people and everybody. We all went to dinner that night, and we had toasts and stuff like that. It was very warm and surprising, given the situation. But it was, we were all together on that, and my people were wonderful.
If that one incident hadn't happened, would you still be on the air?
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Paul.
If that one incident hadn't happened, would you still be on the air?
Who knows? I don't know. I have to tell you that I felt, as I said in the book, Paul, I made it very clear. I felt I was out of place there. I didn't understand the casualness with which people were seeing Bernie Sanders winning all those primaries and coming in so well in New Hampshire and Iowa, and I said, "My God, this is not my world to be in. I don't belong here. I can't be casual about Bernie Sanders. You know, I believed in the Cold War. I don't want to hear good things about the Soviet Union. I don't want to hear good things about Maduro or Daniel Ortega or Castro's. Or I don't want to hear any of that stuff. That's what I've been against all my life. I'm not comfortable with that. And the people around me seem to be." I go, "Why are you comfortable with this? Why aren't you protesting this? You know, Castro came into office and started executing people. Why would you root for him? He betrayed his claim to being a liberal, to be a democratic leader. He was a communist from day one, and he just hid that from us. And, you know, I remember all that. Why would you support somebody like that who betrayed us as he did, and his own people, and basically stole their country from them? I don't get it. I didn't like it. Let me just put it that way. I didn't like it. I didn't feel like I belonged among people who thought that was all right."
Well, what I love is your candor, not only here, your candor in the book. You talk about, you literally come out with the mistakes, things you said on air, the whole, chill up my leg thing with Obama. You talk about that. You put it out. You don't deny anything. You don't whitewash it. You sort of put it out there as moments saying we all have, believe me, embarrassing moments in our career. But I want to just note this while I have you here. You talk about Churchill being your influence, so to speak, in politics, and Hemingway in life's adventure. Have they guided you since you're off the air? Is it still about Churchill and Hemingway for you?
Yeah, I'm thinking about a Churchill book. I've always wanted, I've got tons of his books at home, and I find him to be the man who stood alone against the worst forces of our times, who exemplified personal courage and vision. And his life is a life of had the arc of a hero. Of course, he's my hero. And Hemingway, in a very interesting way, has always guided my life. It's not so much his writing as much as his life of adventure and going to Africa and being in Paris in the 20s and Spain in the 30s. And just his life of action, of writing and action, just so appealed to me. It was very much like Tom Sawyer in Tom Sawyer, where he gets the kids to whitewash the fence. He made everything that he did cool. That's all I can say about Hemingway. He made me want to do what he was doing. And I think that's still true with me now,
I'm inspired too. I have a signed book collection. So when you're next in Chicago, I will share with you my Winston Churchill signed biography and a Hemingway signed book as well.
Well, we're on the same track, sir.
Absolutely. And then finally, the title, This Country, people might have thought you would have ended it, My Country, but the title, This Country, you write about it. It's sort of influenced by Harry Truman.
Yeah, the idea that we were once a country with one voice and not a unanimous voice, obviously. You never have unanimity in a democracy, but there was a sense of us as a people in World War II when Harry Truman did this, he spoke with confidence about this. You know, this country doesn't believe in that, or this country's not going to do that. And that's probably what got him through the 48 election, the big upset, that he understood the country that was united in World War II and through the Marshall Plan, all the things he did. And I kept thinking, you know, maybe that's what I really love about this country, that it can have one voice. It can speak as America. And it does have a cowboy aspect to it. People want to live in their own houses. They want to live in drive in their own cars. They want to make their own decisions. I hope we never lose that cowboy sense, along with our social responsibility and our tolerance of other people's lives and how they live them and who they are. I'd like to see that wonderful vibrancy between tension, if you will, between the independent cowboy, the libertarian, and the person who does have some social conscience about other people. And live and let live attitude. I think that's the tension that makes us a great country. We're not socialists. We're not people who take orders. We don't walk around and say we do everything the way we're supposed to do. We're not all woke. We're all there's always a natural tendency between the social and the individual, which I think makes America. I don't want to lose
great
that.
Words to end. Great word. Beautiful stuff. People who did not know you've written other books, I should tell them. You've written a book on Bobby Kennedy called The Raging Spirit, Jack Kennedy, When Politics Work, Kennedy and Nixon, and of course, Hardball, that one everybody does know. When I do see you, I do have some books for you to sign, if you don't mind.
Thank you, of course.
The current book, your autobiography, This Country, My Life in Politics and History. It's been an incredible career. I just hope it continues into new phases, Chris, because you're just,
you know,
the good, bad, the ugly, warts and all, you've been a very, very important part of the political landscape.
Thank you,
my friend. I appreciate your time very much so. My listeners, I know, appreciated listening to you. Thank you. The great Chris Matthews. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv, and hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes, and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.